So Bob emails, let's read an answer. What do you say?
I think you should have a Donny Osmond poster in this room.
Why?
I don't know. Just get something on the wall.
Let's read some emails. Patron Chris says, I'm an admin on the Facebook fan group. Just chiming in here. Thank you so much, Patron Chris, for being an admin on the Facebook fan group. Going on with the email. I'm currently studying a diploma in relational counseling here in the UK, and I try to... Just chiming in here, what do you think about the change that we're trying to make in our field from marriage and family therapy as a name to relational therapy?
First I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's been in the works for a long time because it's more descriptive.
Yeah.
And, you know, marriage and family therapy has problems because it excludes non-married people.
Right, right.
Couples. And we concern ourselves with relationships generally, not with people who are in a formal legal family or marriage together.
Right.
You can come to a relational therapist as an individual and talk about your relationships. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not holding my breath that we're going to change anytime soon, because we still call ourselves marriage and family therapy. Our license is still marriage and family therapy. Our degree is still marriage and family therapy. Our professional organization is still American Association of Marriage and Family Therapy. It is, you know, we've been trying to change it to couple and family therapy for 40 years, particularly back in the day, to acknowledge gay couples that couldn't get married according to the law.
You'd think they'd not have this kind of resistance.
You know, in academia, which is what this is essentially, because you have to appeal mainly to academia, and then they're the people who go to the state and change all these things, you know.
Right.
It is such a snail's pace. Just as an example, people would quit sometimes, right? Like you'd have a dean that would quit. And we would go on a search to find someone, and we would find someone, and they would be the interim dean, for example, for 3.5 years.
Wow.
So at a university, you can have a job that's considered temporary, and it's literally in the title. You are interim dean. And it's not an anomaly that it's 3.5 years. It's like totally like, well, we just quickly found someone for this job. And so it's on the agenda that within 5 years, we'll find someone that's more permanent. You know, it's that kind of mentality in universities.
Wow.
It's just, everything is just like considered, well, we'll tackle it some other time. And we come from a long line of history, right? It's not like Silicon Valley where someone just says, I'm going to create an app and disrupt blah, blah, blah. You know, everyone has to agree. There have to be meetings and discussions and, you know, quorums and articles and research. You know, it just takes forever. Anyway, so I'm currently studying a diploma in relational counseling here in the UK, and I try to embody what you espouse. I had a bit of a question based on a question to another pod called the Jordan Harbinger Show. Someone wrote to them as a mental health practitioner trying to date in a rural area. She was worried that she could be seen by her clients as a bisexual person. It could cause a rupture with a client, as people might have different viewpoints on sexuality. This doesn't appear to have a guideline from the authorities, at least in the US or the UK. I believe that therapists have a right to live their own lives, but what is your feeling about this level of public discourse or public disclosure, especially for those in a small area where the likelihood of being seen is much higher? Bob, what do you think?
There's no getting out of it. You're going to be seen. My old supervisor, David Taylor, used to live on Bainbridge Island. It's an island population, about 10,000 people. And it's an island. So, you know, it's insular. And he'd say, I hated it. I'd be out in the front yard mowing my lawn with my shirt off, and my clients would walk by. Or I'd go down to the grocery store and I'd bump into my client's, you know, spouse or something. And, you know, it's just how it is. There's just no getting out of it. So I hope that the person will just go ahead and live their life. And yeah, they might run into homophobia, and that sucks. And it would be a tragedy to not live your life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Therapists are allowed to live their lives. Client harm should be considered. But this is far below, you know, like I'm trying to think of a situation where if you're in a rural area, you should think about your clients. Like I'm thinking if, well, but even a political point of view, you should be allowed to protest. You should be allowed to vote. You should be allowed to, you know, put a sign on your front lawn and talk about, you know, that's the American right. You have the right to participate as a voter. I'm just trying to think of anything that would I would consider to be crossing a line of risking too much client harm for your own autonomy, I suppose. Can you think of anything? I can't really think of anything. Because to me, what often gets talked about is, well, you can't get super drunk at the bar. And I'm right. Like, well, why not?
Yeah.
Like, it's not necessarily a healthy thing for you to do. But because I remember hearing that in graduate school, they were talking about how they gave a vignette and they said, so someone got really drunk, a therapist, and was visibly intoxicated at the bar or something. Is that ethical or unethical? And I'm like, it's not unethical because they're off the clock. And if a client happens to see them, I suppose that's a bummer. I think the vignette wasn't even that severe. It was something like just drinking in public or something. And people, the consensus was it was unethical in the class, of course. But of course, you know, classes, as I will sometimes say, I've learned over time that I'm just going to say anecdotally, at least half of what you learn in ethics class is not right.
That's depressing.
Because anyone can be an ethics teacher, you know, yeah. Like you take it from me, like program director,
right.
Ethics classes aren't usually classes that people are dying to teach. And so you're usually scraping the bottom of the bucket for anyone to teach those classes. Not always, of course, but sometimes. And usually they're just from your regular professor pool.
Yeah. Sandra Lippincott, that was ours.
But to become an ethics expert, to know things about ethics in our field and legality in our field, it is a very specialized set of experiences, meaning you have to be an expert witness in court. Most ethics teachers do not go to court because they're a therapist and they teach, you know, it's just one of the classes that they teach.
Right.
They're rarely called into court because that's when you start to really experience, oh, that's how ethics are adjudicated. Mm-hmm. Not only court, but, you know, state boards.
Right.
And the people that do know this stuff, of course, are lawyers who specialize in these kinds of proceedings. And when I talk to them, they tell me very different things than ethics teachers will tell me.
Wow.
Yeah. And so anyway, so clients should be able to date. They should be able to go on Tinder, or sorry, therapists and clients, but therapists we're talking about, should be able to date. They should be able to go on Tinder. They should be able to get tipsy on date night. They should be able to dress how they want, vote how they want, you know, as long as it's legal. Protest and march, join a sex club, wear a bikini at the beach. You know, these are things that I know clinicians, you know, I'm using these examples because I actually know therapists that will do this. And Seattle's not that small, big, you know, you can run into people pretty easily in this town. And if a client is affected, you know, then you discuss it in session. If you run into a client or you tell clients, look, if you ever run into me in public, if you're say on Tinder or something and as a therapist and you know some of your clients might be on Tinder, because the way that, you know, swiping right and left works is you'll go through dozens of faces in one day and could easily come across someone that you know.
Yeah.
And so you might not necessarily say I'm on Tinder, but you could say to a client, you might run into me in public or online. And if you do, please just let's just talk about it. Don't feel like you've invaded my space or something, you know. But I just want to make sure that our relationship is good and that your treatment isn't, and you know, and hindered in any way.
Therapy can be enhanced by such a contact.
Right.
I mean a therapeutic contact in the middle of a session when you're talking about, I saw you on Tinder. Therapy can be enhanced by having that kind of intimacy, that kind of, I'm using all the words that sound provocative. That kind of connection in therapy can be helpful.
It's unfortunate that the word intimacy now is a word for sex.
Sex, yeah.
Because that wasn't the case when we were growing up.
No.
Intimacy was closeness emotionally.
Yeah.
And then it became a euphemism for sex.
Right.
That people would use because they were trying to avoid saying sex.
Sex.
And right. Now intimacy is just, it just means, it's sort of like the word moist is now considered gross. Did you know that?
I've heard something about that. People don't like that word or something.
Yeah.
I don't get it, really. Yeah.
I think for our generation, it's like, why not? Because we heard the word moist being used in non-sexual...
Yeah, my basement.
Yeah.
Which was damp.
Or this fudge. Right. This cake is moist.
Right. Moist cake. Yeah, sure.
Or
I love
this,
moist cake.
This steak is moist and juicy. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And... But I feel like at some point it started being used exclusively in sex or in bodily fluids of some kind. Maybe you're sweaty and moist or something. And then eventually it just became established that the word moist is a disgusting word and should never be used. And it just, it's the one thing that I'll tell you that I feel like I will eventually become an old man shaking fist at a cloud because of these kinds of things. The other hill I like to die on is short shorts. I'll talk about that sometimes, about how, like right now I'm wearing short shorts. You can see them, right? You can see my...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can see my thighs and whatnot.
Sure.
And the shorts I'm wearing right now are actually long compared to the shorts from the 70s.
Oh, sure.
When I wore a lot of shorts.
Watch any NBA basketball.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that wasn't to be sexy. That was just... And to me, it was rational. It's because if you're going to wear shorts, you want to be unencumbered. Uh-huh. You know, you don't want things to get in the way.
There's a reason you're not wearing pants.
Right. And to me, shorts, running shorts, workout shorts, yeah, hangout shorts are supposed to... Anyway... getting back to your email. Also, you know, if you are bisexual and your client is biphobic, then, and that ruins or threatens the treatment somehow, then screw your client, honestly. Just because your client has this biphobic, bigoted point of view and that somehow trips them up in terms of their treatment, then... You know, honestly, they can go to hell. I'm so tired. It's 2021, people. Like, get over it. Grow up. There are bisexual people in the world. There are gay people in the world. There are trans people in the world. Everything's fine. And let it go. And so if you are bisexual and you're in a small community that there's a lot of biphobia in the community, then, you know, I just say, you know, live your life. Having said that, you know, for some people, they're concerned about building their practice and are worried that if they live how they want to live, they're not going to get any, no one will want to go to them because of one identity or another. And so, you know, maybe you have to make some tough choices around that.
You know, it does seem to me two things occur. One is if I have a biphobic, if I'm bisexual and I have a biphobic client and they're willing to work with it, like their own biphobia, that's a real potential. I don't know that it's always the case. I probably rarely are people, you know, but occasionally there's probably going to be people. I don't think we should vilify people that are biphobic or homophobic. I think if it is unwholesome to be around them because it impacts our own welfare and well-being, then yeah, so be it. But if I have a client that's biphobic, that's not a reason to eliminate them from treatment. And if I'm having a counter-transferential response to that, it's worthy of supervision and the potential. And maybe 9 times out of 10 that's just going to go nowhere. But maybe there's an opportunity for at least one person, maybe, to grow. And if I can... I could be a facilitator of that if I'm the bisexual therapist in the small town.
Absolutely.
The other thought I had was a true story about a therapist I know who does not live in the U.S. She's from another country, who was dating somebody who was a little bit younger than her, about 6-7 years younger than her, who had dated one of her clients who was twice as younger. So roughly the ages were my friend was 28, her boyfriend was 21, And the girl he was dating was 14.
So who was the
client? He had dated. Oh, and my friend was the young girl's therapist.
Right.
So she was involved with this guy who had dated her client.
Right. So she's 28. She has a 14-year-old client who has an ex or a current partner who the therapist used to date.
Actually, the therapist was dating the guy because after he had a relationship with the youngster.
Well, if that's true, I mean, that's child abuse.
It is.
Yeah.
She ended that relationship, and it was tricky because she couldn't talk to her client about it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what she did about the legal thing, about the reporting. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Well, it's the police in our neck of the woods.
Yeah. So anyways, there are some circumstances under which, you know, it's going to have an impact on your life and you're maybe make some choices about, like, that would be a really very rare one. Totally colored a view of the man. She didn't know that he had been.
How'd she find out? Did the client say?
I think the client talked about.
Oh my God. Yeah, can you imagine you're dating someone?
Yeah.
And your client, who's 14.
Right.
Says someone abused me.
Yeah.
And he da da da. And you're like, wait, is that the dude I'm dating?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And she couldn't tell him because it would have been a violation of her client's privacy.
Right.
So that she ended that relationship without a word.
Yeah.
Wow. And as I recall, it was painful for her to do that because she liked the guy.
It also,
you know, flipped a switch inside her about, you know, like, oh, that you're not who I thought you were.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's interesting.
Trippy.
Up to your patron, Lindy from Indiana, says, in treating clients that have the same issues you're dealing with in your own life, do you ever find yourself realizing that you might be in the wrong about something? Does this help with gaining perspective? Bob, what do you think?
Yes. It's one of the best things about being a therapist. My old David Taylor, apparently it's David Taylor Day. He used to say to me, I said, David, maybe I'm a half step ahead of, maybe I'm two steps behind this client. He's like, I know, Bob, that's what's great about being in private practice is this is what's going to happen to you. And I'm like,
two steps behind, meaning that you're helping a client with an issue and they're further down the road of recovery than you are.
Their development is beyond my own. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that would, you know, make me anxious, nervous. That guy was fearless. He'd just take anything on and just learn about it. Right. And so, he said, yeah. So, yes, it's really cool. I had a student in my class once and we had a discussion about, should you give homeless people money? And I was stating my very certain, a little bit aggressively certain opinion that you should not do that, right? And she said, well, you know, what if they need money, right? You're walking down the street, you see somebody and they need help. It's obvious they need help. They're asking for help. And you give them some money. I'm like, well, they're just going to use it for drugs. And she said, well, so what? What if they do use it for drugs? Then what? You know, what? Maybe you're helping them hit bottom. Who knows? Maybe, you know. And I really listened to that and I flipped my attitude about giving money to people that are homeless. Now I just do it without any compunction at all. And I don't know where that money's going to go. And I don't think that matters. And I'm often very grateful to that client for teaching me. I you know what I ought to do is I ought to just send her an email and tell her I'm grateful to her. She's a lovely young woman. And
yeah. Very frequently I am in session as a therapist and about, you know, halfway through an intervention or some kind of action I'm doing with a client, I'm thinking, oh, this applies to me.
Yeah.
And it always is liberating.
Yeah.
Or I can't think of a time where it's not, where I feel liberated, you know, and that's the word, I think that's the best word for it is, when, like, I'll be talking with a client and they will be perhaps exhibiting behavior that I observe in someone that hurt me. You know, someone hurts me, hurts my feelings. I'm angry or brooding or something. And then I'm with a client and they're doing something that's similar to the person that hurt me. And I, as a therapist, have an inner perspective and have compassion. That's my boat and I'm not hurt by the client, so I'm free to think more differentiatedly. And so I'm thinking, oh, and I'm talking to them, I'm like, well, you know, you did that and that's not okay, but we understand where that comes from and da da da.
Right.
And then it'll hit me, oh, that's probably what that person did to me. And or that's what I'm doing to other people or something.
True.
And it's liberating because in that moment I see the matrix for what it is, which is that 99% of the time we're hurt secretly, reasonably, and reacting reasonably and misunderstanding each other so frequently, you know. It's such a common scenario.
Yeah.
Then I will either kind of recover from whatever is going on in my personal life, or I'll resolve to take action as soon as the session is over,
right.
You know, like reach out to that person or apologize or something.
Yeah.
So
it happens to me all the time too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of the great things about this kind of career.
Yeah. And by, just as a similar scenario, I've had clients, not frequently, but occasionally, that will exhibit behavior that, or have a personality trait of someone in my past that might have really hurt me.
Yeah.
And as I'm treating them, I'm realizing, oh, you're like so-and-so.
Right.
And I have this really interesting inside view, perhaps, of this person from my past, who's, you know, you're doing what they did, but you're coming to me for help.
Right.
I'm not the enemy.
Yep.
And so now, of course, I'm prone to counter transference against this client because of maybe my feelings of the past, but it's a, and that's happened a number of times too, where I've had what I think to be the opportunity to really, you know, just imagine all y'all out there listening, think about that person from your past. Maybe it's a family member, maybe it's an ex-partner who really just hurt you, and you are at least somewhat, if not very, confused and boggled by who they were and what they did and why, and why did things happen that way. And you just never resolve that because you just never get the opportunity to really unpack that with your with your former partner or your family member or your boss or whatever it was. And then someone comes into your office who seems to be a close facsimile of that person, at least in this personality trait or behavior. And now your job is to figure out why they are the way that they are, you know? And you get this opportunity to go, and every time that this has happened to me, I have learned or confirmed that all this stuff comes from pain, you know, infidelity, abuse, lack of consideration of your feelings. It all comes from pain. You know, people are in pain and they're suffering, and then they will cheat, or they will hurt your feelings, or they will say something that was hurtful or literally abuse you. And it doesn't justify it, but it's brought me, you know, and so, 'cause sometimes people will ask me, they'll say like, I don't understand why you believe that humans are good, you know, 'cause in my experience, not everyone is good. And the average person doesn't really operate from altruism, you know?
Well, yeah.
What?
Well, I don't know if the average person doesn't operate from altruism. That's a fun, that word is, oh, I got lots of thoughts about that word. Sorry. I think I'm...
You have no words about that, about how many words you have about that word.
That's true.
You have a lot of words.
I think my brain just went on a tangent. I interrupted. Sorry.
Well, tell me.
I can't remember what it was.
Oh.
Oh, altruism. I don't believe in it. I think we always have some self-interest.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's a, you know, a belief system, and some people will blanch at how I believe that humans are good and that I see the good in people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fine. It's just a belief. But
yeah,
the part of that might be because imagine everyone who has hurt you in your past eventually comes into your office as a client.
Right. You work long enough, that's what's going to happen.
Right. Then now you are the compassionate, healing presence in all those hurtful people in your past. Mm-hmm. You know, they come into your office begging for help,
mm-hmm.
and you're there to help them. Imagine that, right?
Yeah.
Or everyone that you just imagine to be a bad person, you know, someone who sexually abuses someone, you know, say you weren't sexually abused, but you know it of its existence. And then someone comes into your office who's like that, or a racist person, or a, you know, privileged person of some way. And, and you are now their all loving mother, essentially, as their therapist. And I think that changes your view to a more accepting, loving, I don't know, maybe even optimistic or point of view about human beings.
Yeah, I should hope.
Yeah. You know, as a example of that, I had a client who actually was a therapist who was a hothead in public, and he would, you know, in today's parlance, they'd call him a male Karen, which I find to be just a ridiculous phrase. But he in public would yell at people for various reasons, you know, like if someone was playing loud music at the beach or something, you know, he would go over there and he wouldn't be nice about it. You know, it would really build up inside of him. So he's one of those people that would just walk up to people in public and just, in a very not nice way, say da da da.
Yeah.
And that was a big part of what we were working on.
Yeah.
And I learned, you know, because I've experienced people like that and I've seen people like that and thought, what is wrong with you? Right.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had a chance to learn what was wrong with one of them. And he was not a happy person. You know, it wasn't, he didn't go home and say, I really got them. You know, there was a lot of pain and shame and compulsive attachments to things.
Uh-huh.
Just like ruminating, I guess is the best word. That neighbor who will bother you about this and that.
Uh-huh.
For you, it's just this occasional thing that's bothering you. But to the neighbor, they can't sleep at night because of that thing that's happening on the border between your house and their house.
Right.
Like it's plaguing them.
Yeah.
And by the time they, you know, their plague overcomes their restraint, they're blowing up, you know, they're a bursting volcano and then they come at you. Right. But they're seething about this. It's not a pleasant experience. Right. But it's always framed as like, you know, look at this entitled person, DDD. And it's like, you know, it's probably a part of it. But there's a lot of really suffering human beings with a lot of ongoing distress and pain and anxiety. And then occasionally it gets, their bad mood gets directed at you. And it doesn't justify it. It's wrong. But whenever you see someone like that, just know, at least a part of your conceptualization is like, that person is suffering.
They're suffering.
Like they are, it's not just today.
Yeah.
You know, it is an ongoing thing for this person in all likelihood, you know. Anyway, let's take a break. What do you say, Bob?
Let's take a break.
All right, we're back from the break. Anonymous upper tier patron from Arizona says, how do I process a painful ending of a therapeutic relationship with my therapist? Actually, we have a couple emails about this.
Hmm.
Today, my EMDR therapist of 3 years told me that he is no longer accepting insurance after the first of this year, of this upcoming year.
Mm-hmm.
My cost for sessions will go from $10 to $150.
Mm-hmm.
I will not be able to afford that and continue seeing him. Words can't explain how heartbroken I am. We had a really incredible therapeutic relationship, and I know I will never find it again with someone else. It never occurred to me that this relationship could one day hurt me. I feel so many things that I'm ashamed of, like betrayal, rejection, worthlessness, self-loathing, because I'm relying on my therapist too much. How do I get all of this out of my system in session? A part of me thinks I should just have one or two more sessions to say goodbye and cancel the rest of my appointments to spare myself. Is that valid? Is it possible that this separation may be for the best, as it certainly feels like my attachment I've had all along has reached unhealthy levels? Bob, what do you think?
I think you should read this email to your therapist when you see him next. And I would caution you about precipitously dropping out of therapy. You're not saying anything that says to me that you have any kind of weird attachment stuff. Actually, what it sounds like is you and your therapist have done really good work together. And as a result of your good efforts with one another, you've developed a connection and closeness, and you have an opportunity to work with what it's like to say goodbye to somebody who's important to you. It's unfortunate that this is the case. It's also, you know, therapists have limits, and so this is that person's, you know, that one of their limits is around this shift. And there's no getting out of grief, so don't get out of it.
Right, exactly. The main thing you're experiencing is grief, and it might take a lifetime, and you could do that with another therapist. You're saying that you're not going to be able to find as good of a therapist, and I would say that there's a pretty good chance you will find another therapist that you can bond with as much, a good match. It just might take a few. You might have to go through 5 to 10 therapists before you find another good match like that, but I would highly encourage you look for that. Regarding canceling the rest of your appointments, I agree with Bob that that seems not like the best given what you're saying. I understand the impulse, and I've had clients do this to me where they are very hurt and distressed about an upcoming change, and it becomes overwhelming to them, and then they skip out, and you know, it's fine if that's what they want to do, but if you want to really optimize your transition and your grief, then spending as much time with him and talking about all this stuff as much time as you have would really be helpful, I would imagine. But yeah, it's not unhealthy to be attached. That's the point. And that voice that it's inside of you that's shaming you for being attached to this therapist and being hurt by, you know, the ending of the relationship is an internalization of someone else. You know, someone else in your past told you that you were ridiculous or wrong or clingy or needy or too dependent or something, and that voice is shaming you right now, and that voice needs to be put in its place, because it's abusive to you. It's ridiculous. Humans are dependent. You got attached to a therapist. That's good. That means you worked hard to and opened up and trusted him, and he proved himself to be a trustworthy person. You did everything you're supposed to do, because that's how you healed. It was 3 years of healing instead of 30 years, which is what you were hoping for, which I get. But that was 3 years of healing, and that's great. And it hurts. And that's just, you know, that's life. And it's a sucky part of life, but it's a part of life, and you're experiencing it. And no pain, no gain. And no, you know, if you're going to risk love and connection, then you're inviting grief into your life. Like having this is what it's like when I get a new dog or a cat. It's like I've had so many dogs and cats die in my lifetime that when I get a new dog, I'm like, when is this dog gonna die and I'm gonna be crying? You know, it's just a matter of time. I'm probably gonna outlive, you know, even as a puppy, I'm thinking, well, this dog will live 10, 15 years. But all I can think about is, well, not all, but, you know, occasionally all I can think about is, this is going to be painful. Does that mean I don't get another dog? No, it means that life sucks, but life is wonderful. Life is wonderful, and life has connection and love, and there's a yin and a yang, and the pain will come. And you invited dependency and closeness into your life, and here comes the pain, which is it's just a part of the thing. And what a wonderful opportunity to experience the pain of losing someone. It's much better than being alone. It's much better than avoiding the whole thing. Rudy from Rhode Island says, I've been working with my therapist for over a year now. I'm really connected with her, and we've been able to do a lot of great work together. She recently dropped a bomb on me saying that she will be leaving the insurance panels and that I will have to start paying full price for sessions. The only reason I've been able to see her as long as I have is because my insurance covers a huge portion of my sessions. I may not be able to continue seeing her since I won't be able to afford the full price of the sessions. I feel somewhat abandoned by her. What would be the reason for a therapist to leave the insurance panel so that I can understand her choice a little better? Bob, what do you think?
The insurance company doesn't pay them what they want to make.
Right.
That's the reason.
Yeah.
For both these folks, you know, probably you already thought about it, but it's reasonable to check into what your out-of-network benefit is and what your deductible looks like and what the percentage of coverage you can get. Just ask your therapist what billing code they use, because the insurance companies are pretty squirrely about that and don't want to tell you the reimbursement rate for individual therapy. You actually have to tell them the billing code, but they won't tell you what the billing code is. So get your therapist to tell you what the billing code is that they're using, and then ask the insurance company what's the out-of-network reimbursement rate for this, and you can get a good sense of how much out-of-pocket you're looking at. Some insurances are actually will give you quite a bit back. I'm not on any insurance panels. I got a divorce from all of them for this same reason. And I still get the evidence of benefits letters from the insurance companies when my clients submit for reimbursement. And some of them get a nice chunk of dough back.
How long ago did you divorce from insurance panels?
I did it gradually over about a 3-year period, but probably I got my last divorce probably about 10 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. For me, in the beginning of my career, welcomed insurance paneling.
Yeah.
Because I needed the clients and, people who are coming. So people outside the States might not understand what we're talking about, but the way that it works is that in the United States is that everyone has different insurance. Like in the city of Seattle, you'll have, 25 different insurance companies that are insuring the health insurance for people. There's probably 5 to 10 major players, but the client will come to us and say, I would like to see you. And let's say I charge $150 per session, but especially in the beginning of my career, clients would only, one, they'd be like, I can't afford $150 an hour. Or they would say, I could only afford 3 sessions like once a month or something. And it's like, that's, that kind of sucks for everybody. It sucks for the client. It sucks for us. Whereas if you're on an insurance panel, they will contract with you to lower your price. And so they have a ceiling to how much you can charge. So the insurance company comes to me and says, we will give you clients and we will pay for 90% of the fee for the clients. Therefore, you will have more long-term clients and you'll be able to, and we will just, clients will come to you specifically because you're on the panel, because there will only be a copay instead of the benefit that we're going to give our patients and ourselves. The insurance company is saying, we're giving you this thing, therapist. And the therapist says, and I will lower my prices for you. That's the contract.
Yeah.
And so now some insurance companies will have you lower the fee. The ceiling will be like 100 or 120, which is a pretty big discount from 150, right? But some insurance companies will discount it all the way down to like $40 or $50.
Some of them are really hard to work with.
Yeah. And so you could be a therapist and one client you're charging 150 and the next one is only being charged $50 because the insurance panel, the contract dictates that. Now, the therapist any time can pull out of that contract. But in the beginning of my career, I had enough openings in my schedule that I took the insurance company, like Cigna, for example, would pay, you know, $50 or something. And I was fine with that because it was a lot more money than I was getting paid at an agency, which was, you know, $12 an hour or something. And so overall, it worked out. I had some paying, I think my fee back then was $120. And then some insurances were paying like 110 and some insurance were paying 50 and, you know, it all kind of averaged out. And to some extent I thought, well, you know, I shouldn't exclude people with Cigna just because their insurance is bad. You know, those people need help too. I kind of felt it that way. And then I'd have some clients that I would charge on a slightly fee scale because they didn't have insurance or their insurance didn't cover mental health coverage or, you know, so there's this wide, as a private practitioner, you'll have this wide variety of prices that just depends. And then it's a pain in the butt as a therapist because you have to learn every different insurance company's way of sending in claims. I'm guessing it's easier now with online portals, but back in the day, you would actually type out a claim for every session sometimes. And you'd get paid months later, and there'd always be, you know, there'd frequently be this kind of red tape you'd have to go through. And so when you get to a point in your career as a private therapist, private practice therapist, where you have enough clients who will pay full price or will utilize their out-of-network benefit to bring your price down a little bit, then financially it may, and just logistically it makes sense because you don't have to deal with the paperwork anymore, to divorce from the insurance panels. I'm just saying, I'm no longer going to contract with different insurance companies. And so a lot of therapists, and I've seen it more and more even in novice therapists these days, because there's so much client, there's so many clients begging for therapists, that people right out of the gate are like, you know, I don't think I'll ever panel. I don't think I'll ever contract with insurance companies. You know, I'll allow for out-of-network benefits.
Sure.
Like you said. So Rudy from Rhode Island, and for that matter, anonymous Up At Your Patron from Arizona, it's, you know, that's why therapists will drop insurance, because they can make a lot more money and it's a lot less work. You know, imagine a client showing up in your office and they just Venmo you or write a check, or you just charge their credit card for that session, as opposed to filling out a bunch of paperwork and mailing it in, or going on a really janky online form that you have to fill out that, you know, some of these forms could take like 15 minutes to fill out just for one session. You know, it's a pain in the butt. This one, you know, Regents, it's the Blue Shield in Washington, their portal was, I can't remember what it was called, but they made me change my password every month. Every month, they made me make a new password. Every month. Google doesn't ask me to do that. Facebook doesn't ask me to do that. But, you know, my own insurance company that I have for my own health insurance doesn't make me do that. But somehow this Availty, I think it was called, Availty was the website. And you know how much of a, because like, to every month.
Yeah.
So, and this went on for years.
Yeah.
So how do I come up with a new password? And two, where do I write it down? Like, how am I supposed to remember this? Because eventually I run out of my own passwords, you know, because I have like 5 or 10 passwords that I just know that I use occasionally. But then, and of course, you know, what people listening right now, well, you got to use like a password generator and stuff. And it's like,
those were not available back then.
Right. And I'm old and I don't want to do that. So don't make me.
Yeah, actually security is diminished by that kind of,
I know,
frequent finagling.
Yeah. Ugh. Anyway, but I totally get that it hurts when your therapist tells you something that means you're no longer going to be able to see them anymore. You're not going to be able to afford them for one reason. You know, another thing that can happen is your therapist could just raise their rates, because that happens. You know, therapists can go from 120 to 150 or 150 to 200 or something. And you might be like, that, I just can't. In fact, that happened to me when I was a client. my therapist was giving me a deal. I can't remember exact numbers, but I think it was like, you know, and I'm a graduate student who is slipping further and further into debt.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't have insurance to pay for mental. I had insurance, but I didn't have insurance that would pay for mental health
sessions. That was back in the day when that was optional.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think he was charging me at $75 a session or something like that. And so I was seeing him four times every week.
Yeah.
So that works out, you know, to be at $300 a month, which was not a little amount of money, you know, my rent was like $900 a month or something like $700 a month for rent or something. It's just like, that's a huge amount of money, you know, for a 23-year-old struggling, you know, human.
Right.
And, he raised his rates to, he came to me and he said, if you want me to, I can't remember what it was, but somehow it was going to become more expensive.
Sure.
And I came to him and I said, I was already strapped. Like I can't swing that.
Sure.
You know, I can't do that. Is there something else that we can do? You know, and I understood where he was coming from, I was, you know, it was distressing for me.
Right.
And I think he was, you know, he was fairly cold about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he was kind of a cold therapist to begin with, which is kind of nice on a certain level because he didn't pull any punches with me, which I think I needed at the time.
Uh-huh.
But I do remember feeling, oh, this is okay. So all that's fine. In my looking back, I'm like, hey, he raised his rates. He was matter of fact about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was giving me a deal anyway, and he just didn't want to do that anymore. His practice was getting better and da, da, da. Okay, fine. And I was pushing back or asking him to relent. And then he used something from my life to say, you're resisting this change because of da, da, da. You know, you're resisting this change in my fee, you're pushing back because of your issue with so-and-so.
I'm thinking it's really tricky because where's the transference? Where's the counter-transference? This should be, all these kinds of hypotheses should be stated as such. They are hypotheses for a client to think about and consider. But if you state something like a fact, you invite somebody just to say no. It's like telling someone how they feel. Oh, you're angry right now. If they're not angry right now, or even if they are, being told that that's how they feel will usually invite they'll say no.
Debate,
yeah.
But also, I felt like he was using what he knew about me to get more money out of it.
Well, that's a counter-transferential response.
Yeah, and I'm like, you know, it'd be one thing if he said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is.
Hey, what's this like for you?
Yeah.
Is it, I wonder if it rings like this other thing.
But he got desperate and like, you know, dug through my dirty laundry.
That's leverage.
And pulled something out and said.
That's sloppy.
And I'm like, and I remember being so hurt by that.
Right.
And it really destroyed my trust in him. And I think I terminated like soon after that. I look back and I still appreciate what he did. He was a very formative, you know, of the therapist I've worked with. He was I still think, I mean, that was 25 years ago. I think about things, sessions that I've had with him.
Right.
And I'm not anything like him as a therapist. Well, maybe I am a little bit, but anyway. But at the same time, like the way it terminated, I felt. But in the vein of what we often talk about, Bob, is I didn't give it a chance. I didn't go to him and say, I mean, I think maybe I did a little bit, but you know, maybe that would have been good for my own growth, would be to really go to him and say, look, that really hurt me and I'm really angry at you.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. I just terminated. Well, but I was kind of ready to take a break anyway, I think at that point. But anyway,
I think I often say to people, oh, that's worthy of talking to your therapist about, but I hope I don't indicate that I think it's easy to do it. It isn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Up at your patron, Michelle from North Hills says, hi, Kirk and Bob. Is it a normal phenomenon to have moments of WTF Suddenly, when you remember your partner or close friend is just a random person you become extremely close to. When I have these moments, sometimes it feels similar to derealization. End of email. Do you know what Michelle is talking about?
Yeah, I think it happens to me all the time.
Can you describe what that feels like?
It's like this sort of recognition that the cosmic tumblers of the universe have clicked into place and things have unfolded in such a way that, in this case, let's say you're in my life. Like, what path? You're from Issaquah, I'm from Philadelphia, right? I got here almost on a whim, not quite, but almost on a whim. And then went to, I mean, I think about you and me, I think I went to grad school that fall. I had thought about grad school before, and I thought about leaving the state actually to go to graduate school and tried to do that and didn't. And at first was crushed by that. And well, crushed, that's a bit strong, but disappointed. And then I ended up at school with you, and you and me, we've been friends like this since. And sometimes I'll be like, wow.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a thing right there.
Yeah.
The other thing is, it's like, well, you know, your life is going to be peopled by somebody because you have experiences out there in the world, and some people you're drawn to and some people you're not. And so you become friends with this person or that person, but not that or the other. And so somebody was going to be my best friend.
Yeah.
But it was you.
So, yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
You know, on some level, it's like, well, yeah, of course. But then when you really think about it, in the same way that when I think about how the universe is infinite.
Yeah.
And there's nothing outside the universe, you know?
Yeah.
Like, because my tiny animal brain can't conceive of something that's truly infinite.
Yeah.
That doesn't have an outside to it. And when the Big Bang happened, you know, it's this, everything comes down to this infinitely small point, all the matter in the universe and energy.
That's trippy.
But what's outside of the Big Bang? You know, what does the Big Bang go into? Well, it doesn't go in anything because time and space is what it is. You know, like it is time, it is space, you know, it all of space, all of the geometry of the universe was in a small point. There was nothing inside or outside of that thing. Anyway, I'm like, it just doesn't equate. And sometimes I have a similar feeling, not as frequent, about, you know, the cosmic tumblers, as you say, that align for example, you and I, to me, for me and my wife to have met, actually,
right.
Sometimes you think about that stuff, you're just like, whoa. But I think what Michelle is also talking about is this feeling of, this person isn't really connected to me.
Yeah.
I don't know how to put this into words, but
I get that.
Well, to describe that.
Well, Colleen isn't connected to me. I mean, Colleen's my family.
Yeah.
But then, like, who's Colleen? Like, right. We're not, we didn't grow up together. We don't have history like that together. And yet she's the closest person I got to me. And who, it's like, there's not a connection.
Right. It's sort of like when sometimes I'll just catch my eyes in the mirror. I very rarely look at myself in the mirror, not because I'm not vain, but because I just don't care. I don't know. You know, and my wife, she'll say stuff to me. She'll be like, you have a thing on your face. And I'll be like, oh, really? But I've become much more conscious since I started making YouTube videos, you know, because if I have like a boog on my nose or something, it's like I should probably pay attention to this. And I don't know if you've noticed, but my hair has become much more consistent over time. I don't know if you've noticed.
Did you say
that.
Insistent?
Consistent. But occasionally I'll look at myself in the mirror, in the eyes, and it feels weird. I'm like, who is that
who
person?
Who is that?
Who am I?
Right.
I think a similar thing can happen when we look at our partner or we think about our partner and we're thinking, they're just a random person. You know, I feel like we're connected.
Right.
That they think of me. They know me.
Yeah.
I guess maybe that's another way to put it. They know me. I know them. But then sometimes it's like, do I know them? Do they know me?
Yeah.
How do I know that?
Uh-huh.
I don't... There's... Actually, if I think about it, there's a chance that I don't know them.
Yeah.
And they don't know me. I only see what I want to see, or they only see what they want to see. And so...
The Matrix.
It feels like what Michelle is saying is almost like dissociation, like derealization. Like I'm suddenly becoming untethered from the world and people.
Do you ever do that with your own history? Like I think back when I was 11 or 12, what was my world? My world was, I had a red bike. I lived on that bike. It had a broken pedal. And on my right shoe, I would constantly, had a little nub, and I would constantly try to pedal with one pedal and then this little nub on the right side, and my foot would slip off, and I have a scar on the inside of my ankle from constant, the same bit of me just getting cut, right, over and over again. And that was my world. That bike was my world. I played basketball with my friends, and like that was my world, was like, I go up to school, I play basketball, and I ride my bike everywhere, and I have a cut on my ankle and a hole in my shoe.
Right.
In the same place, and that went on for years. And when I think about what I pay attention to now, like iPads, right? Like, oh, remember pens.
Right. So you're saying like it feels like a different person.
It's like a different guy. Yeah, yeah. A different person.
Right.
This, that, and you know.
And it was like, you know, on a molecular level.
Yeah. Right. Every 7 years, you change your cells. All your molecules change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I know there's a string of continuity from then to now. That's 43 years ago. But it doesn't feel, in some ways, it doesn't feel like that was my world. You know, my dad's wingtip shoes and the front porch with the bricks on the edge and the concrete in the middle and the lamppost that kept rotting out and falling over and the garage door that always hung crooked, which is now not even a garage anymore. My mother still lives there. And
yeah, the feeling that I get as you're talking and I think about my childhood is that it's like a different, it's like a movie that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Or something.
One, like, you know really well, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe this happens as you get older,
I think.
Particularly?
Yeah.
All right, Bob. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.